This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, why medical bills for COVID treatment and even basic tests are about to get bigger. Then, Americans are quitting their jobs in surprisingly large numbers. What is going on? Also, how new momentum for the right to repair movement could save you money the next time your phone or computer breaks. That's coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. Across the country, hospital intensive care units are again overflowing with seriously ill COVID-19 patients. But this time around, people are likely to face much higher medical bills for that care compared to previous waves of the pandemic. The same is true for routine COVID tests that may have been free before. Cynthia Cox is a vice president at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She's been tracking how insurers are covering COVID treatment, and she's with me now. Cynthia, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So what's changed? Why would prices be higher now?
So in the beginning of the pandemic, there were a lot of protections that were being put into place at the federal level, in particular around testing, saying that health insurers had to cover the full cost of testing in most circumstances. There was also talk about whether private insurers should have to pay for the full cost of treatment. So like if you're hospitalized for COVID, whether your insurer should have to pay for the full cost or whether they can impose a deductible or co-payments or co-insurance. And it seems as, maybe perhaps as an effort to forestall a federal mandate, private insurers voluntarily started waiving these costs on their own. So there was never a federal requirement that health insurers, cover the full cost of treatment of COVID. But insurers started doing it on their own, seemingly for maybe some goodwill, but also because they were highly profitable last year.
Most people that have insurance weren't even paying copays. Like if they ended up in the hospital in some cases, this is really intensive care, right? They need, oxygen or ventilators, or it's, like 24/7 monitoring and lots of support. And people were generally not receiving, bills for the portion they would normally have to pay for something like that.
Right. So like, for example, if you have cancer and you're in intensive care and you have private insurance with maybe a high deductible health plan, then you're looking at paying thousands and thousands of dollars for that hospital stay.
Yeah.
But that same, maybe the patient in the room next to you who had COVID, who normally would also have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars, was not being charged by the health insurer because health insurers were voluntarily, for the most part, waiving these costs.
And you're saying they were doing it voluntarily, maybe partly because they figured if they didn't, there would be some sort of federal mandate that would require them to. And so they'd rather kind of avoid having to have a federal requirement so they could have more control over how they do this. But the other piece was that they were very profitable. I thought lots of people weren't going to the hospital last year, except for COVID.
Yeah, that's actually why they were profitable. So, I think in normal circumstances, you might think, oh, the hospitals are being flooded with COVID patients. That means health insurers are having to pay for a lot of hospital care, which means that they're not going to be very profitable. But in reality, that was certainly happening in some parts of the country, but in other parts of the country, people were avoiding the hospital, even people who did not have COVID were avoiding the hospital because they didn't want to get COVID. Mm-hmm. So, someone who needed a hip replacement or some other kind of elective procedure, they canceled those appointments and in many cases may not have ever gotten that surgery done because they've been avoiding the hospital for fear of catching COVID.
Oh, so that's so if you're a hospital, that's bad news for you financially. But if you're the insurance company who has to pay out anytime anyone goes to the hospital who's on your plan, it's actually great news for you financially because people are still paying their premiums, but fewer people are actually turning to you to help pay for their care.
That's exactly right. And, I would say that for an insurance company, that's not it's good news in the moment. It might not be good news in the long run because, some of that care that people were foregoing, for example, was cancer screening. So if you didn't get your mammogram or colonoscopy last year, some share of those people who missed their screening had cancer, but maybe they'll discover it much later now, and that cancer treatment could be much more expensive whenever they do discover it.
Okay. So short-term gain, potentially long-term pain. But
Right.
the short-term gain was one of the reasons why insurance companies could maybe more easily justify just footing the bill entirely for COVID care.
Yeah, and there's another aspect to this that's kind of interesting, which is that the Affordable Care Act, which people also know as Obamacare, requires that insurers limit how much they keep as profits or overhead in a given calendar year. So if in a given calendar year the insurer is very profitable, then they have to return some of those profits to their customers in the form of a rebate at the end of the year, the next year. So insurers kind of knew in the back of their minds, oh, we're going to have to pay some of this money back anyway, and we're worried about a federal mandate to cover treatment costs. So if we voluntarily do it now, that means we can stop doing it whenever we want to stop, and we can, it's just less money that we would already be paying back to consumers as a rebate anyway.
Oh, sneaky. Well, and so now the moment has arrived then, I guess. How have insurance companies, like, how did they decide when it was time to stop fully covering the bill for COVID care?
So, because there's two aspects to this. One is how profitable they are, what the kind of circumstances are around how much care people are using. And then the other aspect of this is kind of PR, how their public image in a way. So, those two things kind of combined earlier this year, because as of earlier in 2021, insurers were no longer as profitable as they had been the previous year. And secondly, there was a vaccine now available that's widely available to, most people, especially all adults in the US, can get this vaccine for free. So, and that vaccine can prevent the vast majority of hospitalizations from COVID. So, the person who's ending up in the hospital with COVID treatment on average is maybe a lot less kind of sympathetic situation now later in the year where, if that person had gotten the vaccine, they might not have ever ended up in the hospital. So insurers, I think, are thinking about this in two ways. One is in terms of their PR. Last year when people were being hospitalized for COVID through no fault of their own, it would have been bad PR to be sending those people huge medical bills. But this year, insurers might be thinking, well, that person could have avoided a COVID hospitalization if they had just gotten a free vaccine. So that group is maybe less sympathetic than they were last year. But also, insurers are less profitable than they were last year because people have started using more healthcare again.
So are insurers then still covering the full cost of COVID care when it's a breakthrough infection, when somebody got vaccinated, or when it's a kid and so they aren't eligible for vaccination and they end up with COVID?
That's a really good question. And I think part of that is that insurers can't really vary how their plan works based on a person's behavior or health status. For the most part, they have to kind of treat everyone equally. And so, yes, unfortunately, for people who have breakthrough infections or people like parents of small children who aren't able to get vaccinated, then they're having to pay a large out-of-pocket cost for that hospitalization when they would have been able, there was nothing they could have done to prevent that hospitalization.
Are we seeing insurers do anything to try to? So the best case scenario for, I guess, for insurers is would be for as many people as possible to get vaccinated
Exactly,
and
yeah.
not end up in the hospital, right? So are they doing anything
Yeah.
to motivate that? What can they do?
So the Affordable Care Act, or also known as Obamacare, limits what health insurers can do when it comes to, kind of creating these incentives to get vaccinated. So, one thing people have said is, well, why don't unvaccinated people have to pay a higher premium than vaccinated people? And part of the reason that that's often not done is because health insurers, can only vary their premiums based on a person's age, where they live, and whether they smoke cigarettes or not. And so they're very limited in how they can vary premiums, meaning they, it used to be that health insurers would charge women more than men, because women are more likely to have higher healthcare costs due to childbirth. But that can't be done anymore. And so, you know, but there are some kind of loopholes, so to speak, in this rule. There's something called a wellness plan, which is a way to charge people based on whether they're taking steps to improve their health or not. And so what we are seeing is that employers in particular have more leeway here. And one notable employer, Delta Airlines, has decided to charge their unvaccinated employees, I think it's $200 a month more than their vaccinated employees for their premiums.
Do we know what effect that's had?
It's actually motivating people to get vaccinated, it seems. According to Delta Airlines, they're saying that since they announced this charge, which I think the charge hasn't even gone into effect yet, they just announced that there would be a charge. Apparently, they had a pretty significant uptick in the number of people getting vaccinated.
I'm speaking with Cynthia Cox, who is a vice president at the Kaiser Family Foundation, and she's director of the Peterson Kaiser Health System Tracker, which has of late been monitoring how insurers are covering COVID treatment. Would people have been notified if their insurance company had stopped waiving copays and cost sharing for, you know, because I could imagine a situation where a family had an individual who was hospitalized last year and, you know, they were like greatly relieved to know that they didn't have to pay any of that. But then this year, now in this Delta surge, another family member gets very sick and goes into the hospital. And the family would be assuming that it would be the same thing as it had been last time around. No, you know, no bills. But then they might get this really bill they hadn't been planning on. Are insurers required to kind of let everybody know very clearly that the rules are different now?
They are posting this on their websites, but my guess is that most people aren't just checking the website of their health insurer on a daily basis. So, you know, insurers have been a little bit quiet about changing this policy. I think if insurers wanted to use this as an opportunity to convince people to get vaccinated, it might be in the insurer's best interest in some ways to say, send a letter out to their enrollees and say, hey, if you haven't gotten vaccinated yet, we just want you to know that that means you're at higher risk of getting hospitalized for COVID and you would have to pay your deductible, which is X thousand dollars. That could potentially motivate some people to get vaccinated. But at the same time, I think insurers don't want people to be afraid of going to the hospital if they do get COVID, because early treatment might mean that that person is more likely to have better outcomes, which might also mean that the hospitalization is cheaper for them. Yeah. So you don't want people waiting until they're very, very severely ill to go to the hospital either.
What have we been dealing with as a nation, just in terms of the costs of COVID care? How expensive is that?
So each hospitalization for COVID costs about $20,000. That's a pretty rough average. You know, certainly if someone's in intensive care and on a ventilator, then you're looking at least maybe quadruple that cost. You know, there's a wide range of costs that can be associated with COVID care, but I think the typical ballpark average is about $20,000. Now, if you multiply that times hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations, that ends up being a lot of money. And what we've done is we've tried to estimate just of the people who are adults who could have gotten a vaccine that would have prevented, you know, 85% of hospitalizations, let's say, we found that just in the last 3 months, more than $5 billion have been spent to hospitalize adults who could have been who could have had their hospitalization prevented. So basically, this is costing billions of dollars. And the people who are picking up the tab, for the most part, are actually not the people who are getting hospitalized. They're paying maybe less than 10% of their total hospitalization costs. The real cost is being borne by society more broadly, which includes taxpayers paying for Medicare or Medicaid, and also businesses and employees paying for private insurance.
Through our monthly premiums. Now, what does this mean, this shift away from footing the bill entirely on the part of insurance companies? What does that mean for COVID tests and the vaccine? Let's take those separately. So So people, even vaccinated people, may still be required occasionally to get a test, or if you have a contact, have an exposure, and, you know, a lot of times your employer might require you to go get tested. Those had been free, hadn't they, COVID testing? What's the deal now as insurers kind of switch to this new model?
Yeah, so I think most COVID testing probably last year was covered for the most part by health insurance companies, especially because last year, in many cases, it would have been medically necessary or medically indicated to get a COVID test. But now this year, we're seeing that there's a lot more circumstances where people are being required to undergo more routine screening. So that could include, for example, returning to work, or even if you're company has a kind of option where you either get vaccinated or you have to submit to regular testing, or returning to school where students might be routinely required to undergo testing. Faculty might also, even if they are vaccinated. So there's more and more circumstances arising as kind of we reopen and go back to the normal world, you know, that or our new version of normal, that testing is becoming more and more commonly kind of routine screening and less about like having a medical need to get that testing. And so that's where health insurers have a lot more flexibility to decide whether they're going to pay for that or not. And if they are going to pay for it, are they going to pay for just part of it or not? You know, so there's a pretty good amount of flexibility where the insurer might decide that they don't have to cover that at all. Or if they do cover it, they might still impose, you know, your deductible or other kinds of cost sharing.
Oh, so it'll just be, again, it's a situation where before you go for the test, it might have been free last year, but you're going to want to check with your insurer before you go.
Yeah.
Because the rules are going to be different.
Yeah, generally speaking, if you're getting the test because you've had an exposure, like a known contact, or because you have symptoms, then it should still be covered. But if you're getting the test because your employer says you have to get tested every Thursday, then that might not be covered.
Mm. In which case, you better talk to your employer because, you know, I could see businesses maybe footing the bill for some of that, potentially.
Yeah, although some businesses are using this as a way to try to convince people to get vaccinated. So they're saying, hey, if you get vaccinated, you don't have to get any testing. But if you're not vaccinated, then you have to get tested every Thursday. And so, you know, then it's not just a matter of the inconvenience of having to get tested every Thursday, but it's also a matter of the cost of having to get tested every Thursday. So employers might want to impose that cost on their employees as a way to convince them to get vaccinated.
Mm. And what about the vaccine? Will people who haven't been vaccinated to this point now be expected to pay more for that vaccine?
The vaccine is still free for almost everybody. There's some circumstances where, you know, if you have, for example, I think certain types of plans that are not really considered health insurance, like a short-term plan, that insurer might not cover the vaccine. But for the most part, everyone can still get the vaccine for free.
Is that going to be like forever, or will there be, because we do know that the U.S. government paid up in advance for a lot of vaccines and the development, at least of some of the major vaccines. But at some point, will that transition as well to, you know, just like when I go to get the flu vaccine, my insurer may or may not charge me a copay?
I think for the most part, individuals will not have to pay for the vaccine, at least for the foreseeable future. Especially, you know, I think we're still figuring out whether people will need booster shots and how often they'll need booster shots. But I think for the foreseeable future, the vaccine is going to stay free for almost everybody. But there is this longer term question of then who starts paying when, like let's say we have to get a booster shot every year, like we do with the flu shot, then hypothetically, the federal government's pre-purchased doses of COVID vaccine may run out, and then private insurers might have to be acquiring the vaccine directly from a pharmaceutical company, in which case, you know, this might be something that has to be dealt with down the road. But I think that we're still probably, my guess is that we're still years away from figuring that out.
Cynthia Cox is a vice president at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She directs the Peterson-Kaiser Health System Tracker, which is a collaboration that's been monitoring how insurers are covering COVID treatment and tests and vaccines. Thanks for your time today, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
Yeah, sure thing. Take care.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, how new momentum for the right to repair movement could save you money the next time your phone or computer breaks. Just ahead, Americans are quitting their jobs in surprisingly large numbers. What's going on? It is so good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. A record number of American workers have quit their jobs in recent months. What is driving the Great Resignation, as some have called it? And why are companies having trouble hiring people when there are so many workers out looking for a new gig? Stephen Courtwright is a professor of management at the University of Iowa, and he's on the line to share some thoughts. Professor Courtwright, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Is there something about the pandemic that's caused people to quit en masse like this?
From what we've seen, the data has everything to do with the pandemic. And so the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been collecting data on resignations for about the past 21 years. And we just saw a huge spike in resignations, the biggest spike they've ever recorded. And so we're really, truly, in the every sense of the word, having record levels of turnover. And like I said, the pandemic has everything to do with it. It's this perfect clashing, if you will, of economic, social, and psychological forces all at play at one single point in time that's really contributing to these massive resignations.
Are some of the people who've been quitting in the last couple of months, would they have quit earlier? Like, did we see fewer resignations last year during, you know, when everything was kind of up in the air with the pandemic?
You know, we actually did. If you look at that Bureau of Labor Statistics data, we actually had the unemployment rate rise at the exact same time that resignations fell. And there's a pretty easy, both psychological and economic explanation for it. And it is that people become more conservative in their decision making when there's greater uncertainty. So at the beginning of the pandemic, for example, when unemployment rises and when market conditions in general are unstable and unpredictable, people tend to hunker down a little bit, become more secure. And so they're staying in their positions more. But as we have progressed in the pandemic and perhaps some level of uncertainty about it, at least from in the labor markets, has kind of subsided. Now, suddenly, you probably have a whole batch of people. We see this from some data that were considering quitting before the pandemic, stayed hunkered down, and now have lots of opportunities to be able to choose from. That's certainly a contributing factor to it. But overall, it's just less certain, more, I should say, there's less uncertainty right now than there was at the beginning of the pandemic. And there's greater opportunities, too, because of the way the labor markets are working right now.
Okay, we'll talk about the opportunities in just a moment. But who would be the person? Could you describe for me what might be going on for a person who hadn't planned on quitting, but has now been through, I don't know, 10 months, 12, 13 months, 18 months even of pandemic work, and yeah, something's changed for them. What would that scenario be?
Absolutely. Well, so let's take a couple of things, because it's not going to be this way for every single person, but there's a lot of different factors at play. So yeah, you take a person, for example, that was considering quitting before the pandemic. Well, the pandemic has introduced new levels of burnout that we haven't also seen lately too. Burnout that's caused by uncertainty, burnout that's caused by trying to, for many people, adjust to a new normal way of working, whether it's hybrid arrangements or whether it's working solely from home. The workload has not decreased during it. In fact, more people report an increase in workload during the pandemic. And without seeing a lot of the rewards behind that either, as organizations have had to tighten their belt, for example. And so
that might be somebody who'd be looking to find a job where they'd work less.
Exactly. Or to find a job in which they find more meaning and balance as well. So, you know, when we also know from research that when times like this happen, when there's big jolts, or we sometimes call them shocks, that happen in the environment, people reassess how central work is to their identity, or how central their current job is to their identity. And they may be striving for different meaning at the same time as they're trying to look for a way out of the burnout they're currently experiencing.
So is there something that happened in, I think the Bureau of Labor Statistics data really took a jump in about April of this year. Mm-hmm. What would have triggered that? Why would April have been the moment a lot of people said, see ya?
That's a good question. And it's always hard to pinpoint the exact causes because it could really be a mix of causes. But if you look back to April, we have vaccinations that are more widely available at that point. And that's certainly, in my own personal opinion, probably would have been the biggest jolt behind this. But again, we can't necessarily identify that perfectly in the data. But that seems to be the month where it was more widely available to the general public. And so we also see at that point the economy, and people begin to kind of get a sense that the economy is actually growing. At that point, it's actually not contracting like it was before. And so, between the economic and between some of the vaccinations, that certainly would have at least contributed in large part to the spike we see in
I
resignations in
see. So
April.
that was also the period where a lot of companies at least started to say, all right, we're bringing everybody back, or, the light's at the end of the tunnel. This is pre-Delta surge. And so maybe that was also a moment for workers to say, I actually prefer to work from home, or I don't want to go, I don't feel safe in the office.
Absolutely. You actually hit on a really important point here, and that is true that in April, so many organizations were starting to develop what return to work plans or future of work plans, and they're starting to make this is becoming the major issue. I mean, back in April, in my role as the director of executive education here at Iowa, I talk to organizations all the time. This is the number one thing keeping them up at night in April and even today. And it's so as organizations start talking about it, then you have people who are thinking about, well, what's my future in this organization? What's my future in this job? So it's again one of those different factors just hitting all at the same time.
Are you seeing companies having to make some concessions in order to prevent resignations then?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the really interesting things to see is just how much the labor market dynamics have shifted. So, if you go pre-pandemic, the power in the labor markets is much more on the employer side. So, they might have a job opening and 90 people apply, and they can be somewhat selective about who they have. But now, as the power dynamics have just simply shifted. There are more openings now than there were before. Organizations are also looking to grow, so they're looking to hire more people. And so, with that, they're having to make several different concessions to try to attract new workers. They're also having to make several concessions to keep their current talent as well, because the options for leaving are just greater than they were before.
What kinds of concessions do you see happening? What would be likely?
So there's always the typical ones like pay raises, for example. You know, if you go look even in more hourly wage jobs and salary jobs, wages being increased is one of the most kind of, basic things that organizations are doing to make concessions. But you also see some other really interesting things that have not really been considered by most organizations. Student loan subsidies, for example, or offers to pay for college tuition. That's something that we haven't really seen widespread yet. And yet we see that in a lot of big companies like Amazon or Walmart, for example. And that oftentimes is a trendsetter for other organizations who feel like they also have to do that in order to compete for talent. And so those are several of the concessions that I've seen being made, both that are kind of general in the pay raise, but also pretty new, like the tuition subsidies and the tuition scholarships.
Are there certain kinds of recruit and retain strategies that don't work anymore in this in this pandemic slash eventually post-pandemic world?
Well, but let's go to the pay raises there, for example. We know from a lot of research in the past that pay raises do help. Companies to be able to retain, particularly their top employer or their top performers. But at the same time, Gallup, for example, has some really interesting research showing that if a supervisor does not engage their employees, no matter how much of a pay raise you give them, they're more likely to turn over. But if you have a supervisor who's really engaging them, helping them to feel passionate about their work, it would take upwards of a 24% raise to be able to lull them away for a competitor to lull them away from the organization. And so I think there's some tried and true ways of retaining employees, and that includes pay raises, that includes engaging supervision. But at the same time, the fact is that in the pandemic, it's just more or post-pandemic or where, at this point in time, I shouldn't say post-pandemic, but at this time in the pandemic, it's just harder to be able to do that because there's more options. And with more options, workers are more likely to consider what their future in the organization. And the more they think about it, turns out from research, the more likely they are to leave.
Oh, That's not very encouraging to any employer. So they have to think about what work-life balance, what matters to you. Is more time off the thing that matters? Is fewer hours, more flexible schedule, those kinds of things?
You know, in the past, we've definitely found from research the flexible work really does help people to want to stay in the organization. That said, of course, organizations have to consider the trade-offs with that. There may be some cultural trade-offs, for example, that come along with that, meaning that perhaps the organization has traditionally thrived on a person-to-person, in-person kind of experience. But flex pay in general, the research shows, does lead to greater retention. And so that certainly can be considered. But at the same time, if you look at it from a market standpoint, that used to be something that would really attract workers because it was more unique. Mm. I mean, before pandemic, less than a quarter of people were working hybrid remote. Now, I mean, other statistics show that 60% of people during the pandemic were working strictly remotely, and organizations oftentimes are trying to find ways to continue fostering remote work. So it doesn't always put companies at a competitive advantage to just offer flexible work. Mm-hmm. There's lots of other options, like I said, the pay raises or engaging supervision that have to be considered in conjunction with flexible work.
I'm speaking with Stephen Courtwright, who's a professor of management at the University of Iowa. What are the jobs or industries that are hardest to fill right now?
Yeah, the data is really clear from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that the two most hard hit industries during the Great Resignation are food services and leisure type of companies, recreation, hospitality, exactly.
Yeah. So yep. Hotels, restaurants, theme parks.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
Why don't people want to go work there? What's the problem?
You know, it's a great question. I think a lot of it in those industries, there's again, a lot of factors at play, but one of those is the meaning component to that too. That certainly plays a role. It looks like from the data anyways, that was collected really even before the pandemic, that it may be harder in, minimum wage or just barely above jobs in those industries to really find a great deal of meaning. Furthermore, individuals may not necessarily be working just for meaning in some of those jobs. They may be working more just to be able to make it by, if you will. And so it does make it harder in those industries. Those were also the industries at the outset of the pandemic that were hit by far the hardest, when travel stopped, when eating out stopped for a time. Mm. And so those are also industries where there may have been a greater shock. It's also those industries potentially where individuals feel less safe in returning as well. So all of those factors are at play here at once.
So what we have here might also be some ramping up, and that's part of why every restaurant is trying to hire in basically
every
town.
Every gas station, every hotel that you go to, they're all trying to hire. That's exactly right. And it's just all these forces at play at once.
Okay. And there may not be, and meantime, people who would have been their best option if they're on the low skilled end of the workforce, are those individuals having other options that are not in leisure and hospitality? Like, is there some new window that's open up for those people who would normally have worked at a restaurant?
I think we'll see that from the data later on as we see some growth in some industries. But, I think what we can observe right now is that, yes, oftentimes they may be trying to switch industries. A low-skilled worker in the hospitality tourism industry can more easily switch to a low-skilled job in another industry, much more than somebody in, for example, a very high-skilled industry in, say, engineering may be able to switch to a high-skilled job in finance, for example. Hmm. The skills may – there are some transferability of skills issues here going on. And so certainly that can play a role in terms of jumping industries and having a little bit more opportunity to do that. But if you're also a low skill worker, you're noticing that the hourly wage that they're offering now, I was at a restaurant last night, a fast food restaurant, $15 an hour is what they're offering to brand new employees. And so it may not necessarily even be shifting industries as much as it is where can I find the best paying job and take advantage of the market conditions and those changing power dynamics.
Yeah. And finally, Professor Courtwright, I have heard some about a mismatch that's happening right now in the labor force in America, where on the one hand, we've talked about hospitality, hotels, restaurants, where they don't need people with skills. They just need people who are willing to do the job. But we've also heard that there are companies out there who need a worker with a specific skill set, and they're having trouble finding that worker. Do you have any insight into why there would be, you know, a skill set mismatch?
You know, it's a really good question. And that has been, I will say, I know that there's lots of articles on that right now, but being in higher education, that's something we've been hearing for years, for example, of I'm looking for people with this skill set, but maybe whether it's universities or whether it's trade schools or whatever, aren't producing that. That's oftentimes just an adjustment that has to be made. And so that's not necessarily, I would not view that necessarily as being in almost kind of the same realm as the Great Resignation, where that's sort of pandemic related. That's pretty common to be facing that. It's just occurring right alongside the massive resignations that are happening. It's also getting some press too, to be sure. But But what's new in this market is more of what we've been describing so far about just the massive amounts of resignations, rather than kind of a mismatch in skills. Universities, trade schools, others will continually adjust to what the market conditions are in terms of, you know, helping people to develop skills that are marketable.
It sounds like, though, from a worker's perspective, right now is a great time to think about a shift in your career.
Be the best time in anyone's career to do it right now, frankly.
Yeah, in terms of all the opportunities.
Yep.
Stephen Courtwright is a professor of management at the University of Iowa. Thanks for your time today, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, if you could get your iPhone fixed rather than go buy a new one, would you do that? The right to repair movement is gaining momentum. We'll find out what that might mean for you. I'm Julie Rose. Good to have you with us for Top of Mind today. What do you do when your cell phone breaks? Your first instinct might be to go see if somebody can fix it for you, a cracked screen or whatever. But have you ever been quoted for a repair that will cost nearly as much as just buying a brand new phone? That's because companies that make our gadgets have lots of ways to limit what can be repaired and who can do that fixing. For years, consumer advocates like the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or PIRG, have been pushing for federal laws that will guarantee people the right to have their devices repaired. The Federal Trade Commission recently announced it is working on new rules to that effect. And there's a bill in Congress called the Fair Repair Act. Nathan Proctor heads U.S. PIRG's Right to Repair campaign, and he's on the line to talk us through this. Hi there, Nathan. Thanks for your time.
It's great to be here.
Is this primarily an issue with tech gadgets, smartphones, computers, tablets?
I mean, no. The truth is that everything that we use has, you know, electronics in it. And as companies have put electronics into all these products, you know, from toasters to tablets to even tractors, they're using the presence of those electronics to lock out repair. And so this has become a problem, you know, for everything. This was even an issue for hospitals trying to fix medical equipment, including ventilators, you know, at the various peaks of this pandemic.
Give me an example of a way in which a manufacturer makes it hard for a product to be fixed.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple standard tactics. I mean, the first might be that they create, very unique spare parts that maybe have, you know, special software coding on them so that, you know, only the manufacturer can supply them, and then refuse to make those available to anyone except for their authorized repair provider, you know, like the dealership or, you know, the Apple store, et cetera. And they're the only place that can get access to certain kinds of materials and parts. The second is software, right? We know that these products are, you know, they run on software. And if there's a software repair tool, that becomes a proprietary, you know, product that only, again, the authorized repair provider, whether that's the dealership or another kind of, branded store, has access to that material. And then therefore, nobody else can do that repair. Or if they do actually do the repair, then they can't like reset the product so that it's in use again, because there's some kind of firewall in between, you know, the part getting replaced and the device powering up and working as normal again.
Mm, okay, so a manufacturer of a thing can build in these roadblocks, and that is, are they doing it intentionally, and that's perfectly legal currently?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, this is happening in every industry. So, like, the farming industry is a good example. Like, modern tractors, you know, or combines, you know, one of the combines we looked at, we read the service specs, it has 125 electrical sensors in it. And if any one of those sensors, you know, goes out, you need to install a new one. You know, that requires a software tool, which right now John Deere only makes available to the John Deere dealerships. So yeah, there's just no way to completely finish that repair unless you go to the dealer.
And is it going to be more expensive at the dealer?
Yes, the dealer prices are higher across the board. You know, and then also John Deere has said in company filings that it makes the profit margins are like 6 times higher for their service and repair, you know, parts of their business than for the sale of new equipment. Hmm. So they have a huge incentive to kind of gobble up all the market share for the service industry that's connected to these products. And obviously, if you're a farmer and you've got equipment, you paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for it, you need it to make a living, and it breaks, you're going to want it repaired as soon as possible. And you know, and they've kind of got you over a barrel at that point.
Is this a new trend?
You know, that's an interesting question. And there's a lot of history to the balance between, you know, protecting the rights of companies that make things and protecting consumers, to own those things. And actually, some of these protections that allow people to fix things without trying to infringe on patents or other manufacturer rights date back like over 100 years. And this is a balance that's kind of always been in play. Like, And the idea was, yes, we should protect companies that are making new products. You know, we shouldn't let other people just steal their ideas because that would undermine innovation. But we need to protect consumers from being price gouged on repairs or having completely monopolized repair. And so there's kind of right to repair protections in the older parts of copyright and intellectual property law that date back over 100 years. But really things have changed because it's all software now. And so the protections for copyright are much broader than the protections for patents. Mm. And some of this balance between consumer rights and manufacturer rights is totally akimbo, which makes it so that, yeah, Americans dispose of 416,000 cell phones a day. And companies are aggressively pushing these obsolescence techniques on us.
And companies that make these devices are still making an intellectual property argument that they need to protect all of the things that make their device so great. And they're not just going to circulate the how-tos to any old fix-it shop who'd want to, you know, start fixing their smartphone. But they also make a safety argument. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah. And honestly, they don't make the intellectual property argument to actual intellectual property attorneys. They tend to do that with people who don't really understand intellectual property law because it's not a very strong argument. But the idea with the safety argument they make is that, listen, we're the only people who are, you know, equipped, trained, smart, careful enough to fix stuff. I mean, and by that argument, you know, you shouldn't be able to change the oil in your car. You shouldn't be able to change the tires because, you know, if you do it wrong and the tire comes off on the highway, you know, you could cause a big accident. And of course, you know, the FTC, before they, you know, kind of announced that they were going to start investigating and enforcing repair restrictions as antitrust and anti-consumer violations, they did a big analysis. And they looked at, you know, all the data that the manufacturers could provide on whether or not they were justified in having these restrictions on repair. And they couldn't find basically said there was no evidence that there was any safety concerns with independent repair, that there was one example of a damaged product from Australia from 2011 that somebody had a battery fire associated with an improper repair. Mm-hmm. That was it. I mean, there's hundreds of millions of these cell phones out there that are getting fixed by local shops all the time. And their only evidence that this was a problem was from Australia in 2011. So yes, they do make this safety argument. But obviously, you know, society, people, citizens manage the risk of fixing their cars or fixing any of the products in their house. They make a determination on what they feel safe with. And then what they don't feel safe with, they take to somebody that they trust. And that's the same thing that should be happening with every product.
So what's the goal? Who would you at US PERG like to see able to repair a device?
I mean, I think it's about choice. So, right. So I hope that companies can make products in such a way that people like have more self-repair options, right? That people feel it's easier to do DIY repair because that's really cheap and efficient. And it teaches people how technology works, and that's just good for society. But I recognize that a lot of people aren't going to want to do that. But they should have a choice. They should be able to go to a repair shop that they trust with, get a competitive price, so that more of our stuff keeps working and stays off the scrap heap.
How does it work, though, with some of these? I mean, there are half a dozen of these, like, we fix your screen type shops in town that are not official Samsung or Apple dealers. And as far as I know, don't have the official, you know, repair shop seal of approval from the manufacturer. They're doing it somehow. How are these kind of independent fix-it shops doing it? And what more would a right to repair piece of legislation allow them to do?
Yeah, right now those shops, if they do screen replacements, for example, they won't be able to buy the actual original part. So they have to find and source an aftermarket part. And some of those parts are honestly better and cheaper. But in other cases, they just can't find the part you need. And there's a lot of phones. Like, I mean, if you have an Apple phone, you'll probably be able to get a screen repair. But if you actually have another phone, you might actually find it really challenging. Mm-hmm. The parts might be prohibitively expensive, or just too difficult. The phone is not designed in such a way that makes that repair cost effective, which is just outrageous. But they can find an aftermarket part, in part because there's so many Apple phones around and they don't have that many models.
Okay. So an aftermarket meaning that they'll refurbish it from a discarded phone that they might
Sorry, I shouldn't have used that phrase. Aftermarket just means not the manufacturer. So like when you go to Pep Boys for car parts, you're going to get aftermarket parts, which are not, you know, original BMW or Hyundai parts.
Okay.
But companies make compatible parts you know, common models.
Okay.
But the problem is that Apple and other manufacturers are increasingly locking the software in the part to the device. Mm. So if you get like the newer iPhones and you replace the screen and you don't go to the Apple store or to the Apple approved location, you're going to lose some of the functions of that screen. Like the Face ID might not work anymore. Mm. You know, they're gradually kind of like, they don't want people outside of their control getting their stuff fixed.
Some kids in the background. Gotta love it.
I apologize for that.
That's okay. Nathan Proctor, you mentioned a moment ago that with my car, so I have a Honda, I can take my Honda to the dealer. And for certain things I do there because they're, you know, they're pretty comparable in cost and I like the service that I get. But I can also take it for some things to the neighborhood fix-it shop, the mechanic, and get it fixed there. Why can I do that with my car, but not with my phone?
So the reason why is because Massachusetts voters in 2012 voted 86-14% to pass a ballot measure to require auto manufacturers provide independent repair shops with the diagnostic and repair information that they make available to dealers, and to also standardize the onboard diagnostic readout so that there's a standard tool now which you can get and read any car's. Like if your check engine light goes on, you take it to the mechanic, they plug in this tool, they know it's exactly what's wrong. Mm. Now, if you have a same problem on your John Deere tractor, you don't have the same, you can't go to the local independent mechanic. You know, they're not going to have access to the tool that John Deere Deer has, the dealership has. So it's become exclusive in that way. And so,
it was legislation in Massachusetts
that eventually became a national agreement where all the automakers agreed that they would do this. And that basically started the right to repair, you know, movement, where repair.org, which is a big coalition of repair groups, and iFixit, they started taking that idea and bringing it to other states. And which is actually had 27 states with bills over the last year. So this is something that a lot of states are looking at because people just want to fix their stuff.
And the act that's currently in Congress, the Fair Repair Act, just briefly, we have about a minute left, would effectively do that nationwide.
Yeah, that would be that's basically a national version of all the bills that we have going in the states. It requires manufacturers to give consumers and independent businesses access to the things you need to fix stuff, spare parts, diagnostic tools, you know, any of the repair materials. So to enable competition in repair markets so people can fix stuff.
Nathan Proctor leads the Right to Repair campaign at the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or U.S. PIRG. Thanks a lot for taking time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And then, you know, thank you for also welcoming my children onto this radio show.
We are family friendly and happy to welcome them anytime. Thanks a lot.
All right.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. If you walk down the streets of any major American city, you'll see impoverished people, cardboard bedrolls, and tents. Homelessness increased last year, but it seems like it really exploded in West Coast cities like Seattle and San Francisco. Recently on Top of Mind, we learned that New York and D.C., actually have higher rates of homelessness, but they've also got a lot more shelters to house those individuals, so the problem is less visible compared to cities on the West Coast, which have not invested in as many shelters. What cities with the highest rates of homelessness in America do have in common is a lack of affordable housing. Check out our deep dive into why homelessness seems like it's such an intractable problem. You can find that on the Top of Mind podcast. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First, the pros and cons of ranked choice voting. Don't worry, we'll explain what it is. Then, best-selling author Shannon Hale's new teenage memoir makes adults squirm.
And kids read these books and they go, oh, what a relief. Somebody is showing me what's actually happening. Thank goodness. And this is hilarious. We take it harder than they do, from a distance than they do in the middle of it.
Also, how to enjoy the company of your own thoughts. It's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. How many times have you wanted to vote for a candidate in an election, but you haven't because you knew that person would not win and you didn't want to waste your vote? I feel that way a lot during elections, and it's really frustrating. Well, there is a kind of voting system that addresses that problem. It's called ranked choice voting. And you do just like the name implies. You rank all the candidates in order of your preference. So if your first choice gets eliminated early, your vote for your second choice goes into the hat, and so forth. Cities and states have experimented with this. New York City's recent mayor and city council elections are the largest example to date. And Drexel University political scientist Jack Santucci is on the line to talk a bit about how it works. Hi there, Professor. Thanks for your time.
Hi, Julie.
When a city or state adopts ranked choice voting, why do they do it? What is the problem they're trying to solve?
Well, typically there's some local movement or local pressure for it. We've seen a lot of different reasons for cities to adopt ranked choice voting over the years. And when I say over the years, I mean 80, 90, up to 100, sometimes even more than that. But the real interesting thing about ranked choice voting, a voter knows it as voting 1, 2, 3. But the interesting things are what happened before and after the voter votes 1, 2, 3. That's, I think, where the problems start to get thought about and solved.
Okay, so for example, what do you mean?
We can have a ranked choice system that is designed to have 3, 4, or 5 parties represented in city council. We can have a ranked choice system that is designed to let voters choose among 5 Republicans and 4 Democrats. We can have a ranked choice system that lets voters choose among 1 Republican, 1 Democrat, 1 Green. So to give you a sense of some of the variations
right
that are out there.
Okay. So, but fundamentally though, why shift away? Like why would, if it's usually a citizen movement that wants this to happen, I mean, are they like me and they're just tired of feeling like they have to wait, they don't want to waste their vote. They're tired of not being able to vote for a third party candidate? What's usually the motive that kind of gets people energized about an idea like this?
Historically, it's been some sort of major event in national politics. So the Trump 2016 election, where he has fewer votes than his leading opponent and yet becomes president, that's the kind of thing that galvanizes interest in these reforms. And if we go back a century, we get the same kind of thing with Teddy Roosevelt in the election in 1912. So it's those sort of nationally traumatic elections that really get the public interested in this stuff.
Where you get some kind of a spoiler, or you get a situation where somebody wins without having gotten a majority of the votes, which happens quite often in our electoral system.
Well, I mean, there's a perception that there's a spoiler. I mean, we just had some research come out in Political Science this week that shows, in fact, that the 2016 election wasn't spoiled, but I think many understood it to have been spoiled at the time.
Okay. Okay, so one of the criticisms of ranked choice voting is that it's confusing for voters. Does that prove the case? Are voters able to figure it out?
This criticism is goes back to the 1890s, and I think on the whole there's some level of confusion. For example, in Australia, where this thing has been in place for a long time, we typically see about 5% of ballots invalid. Now, that may not be due to confusion. That can be due to any number of things. But I think when people say confusing, a lot of what's going on is that it's unpredictable. Unpredictable for sort of political elites and party leadership more broadly.
Okay. So one of the things that it makes possible is a come from behind win, kind of more dramatically, right? Explain how that would maybe play out in a ranked choice voting situation.
How would it play out?
Yeah. Like what would, you know, if you're like watching the returns come in throughout the night, you could have a certain, at some point during the night, someone who hasn't reached the threshold, they kick that person out of the running and then divvy up all of that person's votes. And so maybe that person, you know, is also kind of similar to somebody who's in third place. And so all of a sudden the third place person jumps up to second place or even first place. So it kind of creates, is that the unpredictability you're talking about there?
Well, in the United States, that type of outcome tends to be unpredictable. And I think that's a lot of the reason. So I'm doing some research now where we look at come from behind winners and repeal activity. And historically, there's a bit of a relationship between come from behind winners and repeal activity. But when we go to other countries, that's not so much the case. I think people are sort of used to seeing come from behind winners and as a sort of matter, it's just kind of a fact of everyday coalition politics that you might, right, when you have a multi-party system, it's not uncommon for two small parties to gang up on the largest party. And that's the kind of thing that'll give you a come from behind in another country. Here, of course, we have a two-party system,
right?
Too weak, right? So,
So anyone who voted, if the third party candidate or the independent candidate clearly doesn't have enough votes, all those votes just languish rather than going into somebody else's bucket.
That's possible, right? You might get some of that is called ballot exhaustion. But a good example of this, I think there was an election in Pierce County in 2008 where there was an independent candidate. And this is one of the sort of few come from behind wins we've had in the United States. And when you look at the destinations of that independent candidate's ballots, they kind of went in both directions. That's what I mean when I say unpredictability. If we go to Australia, we know that the voters of a certain party are going to give their second choices to a certain other party.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You see what, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in the United States, you could have libertarians who would give their vote to a Democrat and you could have libertarians who would give their vote to a conservative. It could kind of go both directions.
Right. And you don't really know what's going to happen.
And okay. So who clearly wins in a ranked choice voting system in terms of candidates or parties or voters? Like what are the clear advantages?
Well, I mean, I think it's part of a larger global trend of giving voters the opportunity to sort of express their preferences about individual candidates. So if we go to Western Europe, we see other things like this happening. It's not ranked choice voting, but sort of other ways to give voters choice within parties in those multi-party systems. But the research isn't clear that it changes policy outcomes.
Does it, though, make it possible for more moderate candidates to win? Like in a primary situation, right?
So what Yeah. So a moderate would be sort of someone who appeals to both sides of a fight.
Yes. Yes. Someone who, for example, in some states, if you, you know, they're like the party diehards who are really conservative in the Republican Party, and they're going to pick a certain kind of candidate. But if you just put all of the people in the running onto a ballot and let in a ranked choice situation, I guess the question is, does it encourage coalition building? Is it going to encourage a more moderate candidate ultimately, or empower that individual who can't play really strongly to the, you know, to the red meat on either side?
I think moderation is a choice. And sort of if you're a cynical campaign consultant, right, the way to win a ranked choice election, if you're working for one of the leading candidates, is to sort of convince voters to vote for anybody but X. So, you know, it's not going to get rid of polarization in that sense, mm-hmm. right? It just changes the way that it plays out. But moderation is sort of a policy choice. So you've got me thinking about Alaska, right? Where the conventional wisdom is sort of, you know, Lisa Murkowski's there and she's a moderate Republican. You know, what would it take for her to sort of win? I think some portion of Democratic Party leadership up there is going to have to convince Democratic voters, Democratic rank and file, that, yeah, we want to do this. We want, you know, vote for Murkowski. Don't sort of let's not have a very fragmented three-way election, if that makes sense. Mm. And that's what I mean when I say that this is really a policy choice. It's a moderation's a choice. The system itself doesn't generate sort of moderate outcomes. Coalition build, you either build coalitions or not. And that's true of in any electoral system.
So, but don't you have more of an incentive to build a coalition with other, you know, like-minded candidates if it's a ranked choice situation where, you know, you know that you could get that other person's votes if they don't reach the threshold?
Potentially. But if you're the kind of candidate who wants to win, you also have an incentive to be number one and be number one for as many people as possible. And backing up from that, if you're an interest group or a party leader or you know, someone who's sort of behind the scenes in politics, you know, you may want to get together with other people like you and say, hey, who's our candidate in this election, ranked mm-hmm. choice or not?
What about the idea that that it would be ideal, maybe in some people's minds, if the winner of an election actually got the majority of votes? Does a ranked choice system at least make that happen or more likely to happen?
The only way to guarantee that the winner of a ranked choice election is going to have a majority of votes is to require voters to rank all choices.
Hmm.
And that is what Australia does for its House of Representatives elections. And even there, some percentage of ballots are invalid, which is probably due to protests. People saying, no, I don't want to rank all choices, rather than due to confusion, right? Because Australia teaches you from the age of 6 months that yeah. voting is about going 1, 2, 3.
Wait a second. So when you have, like in the New York elections, where there are people right. who just, they picked their first choice and then they're like, I don't know who my second through fifth choice is, so I'm just not going to put anything in those sections.
There's some percentage of that. The last thing I heard was that most voters ranked at least two choices, but we're the sort of political science communities waiting to see what the analyses of the ballot data look like.
So what happens then if I only rank my first and second choice and I don't rank 3 through 5? What happens to my ballot if my first choice and my second choice get eliminated?
It exhausts. It does not continue into subsequent rounds of counting. And that's why we'll say, you know, the winner had a majority of ballots that continued to the final round of counting.
Okay. And so that's how you could still end up with a situation where the winner didn't get the majority of votes cast, period, because
correct.
some people just didn't list their choices. And so their ballot went into the I guess inactive pile once their first and second
digital pile.
Interesting. Okay. So this has, why is this gaining some momentum, would you say, in the United States right now?
I think part of it is that, you know, nationally shocking event that we all lived through a few years back. But the other big part of it is that people are just generally unhappy with political parties right now. That's especially the case among young people. And
they
just
see
go
this as a way.
What's that?
They see ranked choice voting as a way to empower alternate parties.
Yeah, just it really kind of becomes a vessel for anti-party sentiment. This happened during the progressive era. I think it's happening again.
Jack Santucci is a teaching professor of politics at Drexel University. Thanks a lot for your time today, Professor.
See ya.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we hate to sit with our thoughts. We'd rather whip our phone out, or as one study found, we'd rather get an electric shock. Why would we rather do that than be alone with our own thoughts? Just ahead, best-selling author Shannon Hale has a new memoir of her eighth grade year. It's really cringy, but that's why kids love it. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. It is great to have you with us. Shannon Hale is known for her best-selling fantasy novels for young readers like Princess Academy and The Goose Girl. But her latest is a very realistic account of what it's like to be in eighth grade. She captures the fear and anxieties and the intense emotions of that period of life so well and so honestly. I found it at times a bit too real. I had to put the book down and breathe and remind myself that I am not still in middle school. The book is called Friends Forever, and it's a memoir in graphic novel format, illustrated by Shannon Hale's close friend and frequent collaborator, Lewin Pham. And the two of them are with me now. Shannon, Lewin, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Julie. Glad to be here.
Thanks, Julie. We're happy to be here.
Shannon, was it always clear to you that your eighth grade experience in Salt Lake City, Utah in the 1980s was worth writing about?
No. No is the very adamant answer. No, I never thought I would write a memoir. I felt like I was a normal kid. I didn't have anything interesting happen to me as a kid. And then I've got four kids. And when my second oldest was going through some tough times with friends, I wanted to tell her stories about the challenges I had with friends at her age. So I thought, I will write my story, but in a graphic novel format so that she could read it. And the whole time I'm writing it, I'm hearing a voice in my head go, "Shut up, Shannon. Nobody cares that people were mean to you when you were in fourth grade.
You're just so hard on yourself."
I am. But thinking about my daughter gave me the courage to do it. And what blew me away when that first book came out, Real Friends, was how quickly people responded to it. I've published over 30 books, and I've never had a book catch on so fast, where by the second week it was out, I was meeting kids who had read it 25 times.
Yeah, it's the loveliest thing. Like I've done picture books, and I don't get the same response as Shannon does with her books, because, wow, she cuts her veins open. She bleeds on the pages. And to witness how kids reacted to the first book in the series, like Shannon was saying, we were standing in line, and I remember a girl, the book had been out for 2 days, and the girl in line had a dog-eared copy. It had been clear. She'd read it a million times over. She'd taken it with her everywhere. She was, you know, reluctant to relinquish it to us, even to get it to sign. We could sign the book. So there was something that Shannon really tapped into with these books that it's been amazing to see.
So as you've mentioned, this is a trilogy. Real Friends was the first in the series, came out a couple of years ago. And it's, Shannon, you're in fourth grade at the time. And then the next one is called Best Friends, and you're sixth grade in that one. And then this one, Forever Friends, is eighth grade, right? And so this one, what were you tackling in this one that, you know, that maybe felt different? How did it compare to writing those other two for you?
I hadn't intended to make a trilogy. I intended to write one book, but after seeing the reactions of people, I kept thinking about sixth grade, and I feel like I had more to say that I hadn't been able to deal with. Specifically, I grew up with an undiagnosed anxiety disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder, and I didn't have words for that. And I wanted to spend some more time showing what that felt like. Friends Forever, the third one, about eighth grade, that came about because I didn't want to do another one because they're really hard. They're really hard to write.
I made her do it.
What's hard? Just explain that. Why are these really hard to write for you, Shannon?
Every book is challenging. Every book just kicks my booty. But graphic novel is the most challenging format. You write in panels. So page one, panel one, describe what's happening in the panel, and then write any dialogue or captions that might be there. page one, panel two, the same thing. Thinking in that format is, it's very hard to do well. But on top of that, writing memoir, you know, I feel like, you know, I'm 47, I've got four kids, I've got a career that I'm really proud of. I think I'm okay. Like, I'm okay. And then, like you, how you felt when you were reading it, that's how I felt when I was writing it. But I was writing it for months and months, you know? It's like 9 months of feeling like I was still in eighth grade. But it was almost harder as an adult going back than being there, because you have that different perspective. But it was also really good for me to remember and to have more compassion for my kids and other kids, to remember how hard it is. But as you think you're out of it, but you never really are. And you go back and you feel those feelings. I listened to the music I listened to at the time to bring back those feelings. I read my journals. I have a shoebox full of notes that my friends passed me in eighth grade so that I could read those and remember things. And it was hard to put myself back in there all over again. And I don't think I could have done it if, first of all, if I didn't have this idea outside myself, like, this is for my daughter. And second, I couldn't have done it if I didn't know that Lay Wen Pham, my best friend, was on the other side of that script. It's going to be in her very safe, capable hands, and she's going to be able to illustrate it in a way that I know it's going to be communicated with compassion and with love and with honesty.
And Lay Wen, what was it like for you illustrating Shannon as a very vulnerable, sometimes deeply sad, and sometimes not very nice, you know, at her worst moments in some cases too, you know, eighth grader. What was that like for you?
You know, I'm going to give my hats off to Shannon on this one. She was really candid in her behavior and what she did in moments where she herself wasn't behaving very well either. She was really honest about portraying herself in your complicated form when you're a kid, because you don't realize half the time sometimes that you'll say something that might hurt someone's feelings. Just like you can't understand how something someone else says would just devastate you. And so Shannon was amazing in that she could tap into that childhood self, and yet she could also pull back as an adult and see the nuanced situation that it actually was. And so for me to be able to illustrate that, because I am not Shannon, I am trying to interpret what her words are. And on top of all that, I'm her friend. I'm being very particular in how I interpret some of what Shannon's words are and what it is that she's trying to comment. I mean, the panel might read, you know, for Shannon that Shannon sits in the locker, her friend has just left her, and she looks desolate. And of course, I've got to translate that into something, and immediately I want to, as a friend, punch up really close to her face and just draw her as though I'm hugging her. But I know that at that moment, as a storytelling moment, you can't do that. You can't let the reader in into that intimate moment. You have to somewhat judge the character at that moment. And so you end up pulling back the panel and showing Shannon from a very small perspective, from an overhead angle. And it becomes very cinematic at that point, where you have to rely on your visual cues as a visual storyteller to be able to communicate that moment in a different way.
And there are so many thoughtful decisions that Wen makes every single panel.
Shannon, would you describe a panel where you, in this book, Friends Forever, where you feel like Lay Wen just really captures the overwhelming emotion of being a 13-year-old girl?
One comes to mind specifically in the first book, in Real Friends. There was a really hard scene where I had an older sister who was pretty rough with me, and I had run away from her and was hiding in my bed. And then she comes in to continue yelling at me. And Wen pulls in really tight. You're like right on the faces. And boy, you feel it. You feel that moment so much. It would have had a different feeling if it had been a wide shot where you're just seeing her lying on the bed and the sister yelling over her. But instead, you're right in their faces. There's no escaping the facial expression that gives you that emotion. Yeah. And that was a tough moment, even though it's like a very normal thing in a big family. There's going to be sisters yelling at each other. You know, there's going to be an older sibling who might be rough on the other one. That's not a unique trauma. That's commonplace. But she allows you to feel how it feels. Even though it's commonplace all over the world,
it still hurts that one kid. It still matters to them. And she shows that.
There's something in this particular book, Friends Forever. Shannon, she moves from anxiety towards depression. And it's something in the book that it happens very subtly in the telling of it, that right. you can sense it. And I knew that I had to find a visual way to get that across to readers as well. So Shannon, in this particular book, as she sort of descends into deeper and deeper depression, the panels, they start to become slightly desaturated. The colors start to go away.
Yeah.
And it reaches a point where the book is practically black and white. And the only thing that you can see of color is Shannon's hair, just so you can differentiate her from the other characters. And it's one of those things where those are visual cues that I'm trying to put in so that the reader is reading it and doesn't necessarily feel it. Like the idea, in the same way that when Shannon's writing, she doesn't want to hit you over the head with any information, it goes the same with the illustrations. You're trying to be so subtle that the reader doesn't understand, why am I feeling sadder
yeah.
as I'm reading this book? Why am I feeling a little less colorful? It's because you are literally experiencing the world in a slightly colorless way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the purpose of a story, especially stories like these, is to tell you these stories in order to evoke an emotion. And then the reader feels that feeling as they're reading it because the story evokes it in them. And even if that same thing hasn't happened to them, they have felt that feeling in a different time, in a different circumstance, and they get it. And that's how empathy is bred and born.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Shannon Hale, who is the author of a trilogy, the third of which has just come out, called Friends Forever. It's a memoir in graphic novel format of her eighth grade year, dealing with anxiety and undiagnosed depression, along with all of the very normal things that middle schoolers experience at that age. And it's illustrated by Lei Win Pham, who is a close friend of Shannon Hale, an award-winning illustrator herself. And the two of them are with me. Do you think that this book is... It was so hard for me to read because, I mean, this was the age, we were middle schoolers at the same period of time. And so the hairstyles and the clothing and the references, the cultural references, like it was very transporting for me, which I wondered why maybe it was also a little triggering as a result. And it was just so normal, right? Like there's nothing like dramatically unusual that's going on in your life. You're trying out for the school play and your friends are starting to go with other boys the way they would talk about, you know, dating other boys, and you're wondering if your hair isn't cooperating, and you know, just like the normal, and you're having arguments with your friends and communicating via notes because we didn't have texting back then, and so you're like passing notes in the hall to each other. Yeah, and so it's all very normal, and yet also the anxiety and the way that the self-talk, the like really kind of self-loathing self-talk that is sort of driven by your anxiety and depression, and the way that that's depicted so powerfully through the visuals in this book. I guess I was wondering, like, what is this going to do for kids? I mean, it was intense for me to read it. How do you think kids perceive this, who are like in it at the moment and can't step away and breathe and be like, oh man, thank goodness I'm not a 13-year-old anymore?
Do you know what's funny? I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is the impression I hear from a lot of adults. Adults read these books and they say, it's too much. This is too hard. I don't think kids can take this. And kids read these books and they go, oh, what a relief. Somebody is showing me what's actually happening. Thank goodness. And this is hilarious. They have a very different perspective. We take it harder than they do from a distance than they do in the middle of it. That's what they're living. And, you know, it's very validating. It's so important just for positive emotional health. To have people around you validate how you're feeling. When people deny how you're feeling, you don't really feel that way. That's not what's really happening. It's exhausting, and it makes you feel crazy. And that's how I felt anyway, using that word in its original meaning, which was, you know, derogatory and negative. But when kids read it, they feel validated. They're like, someone is showing me how I'm feeling, and that's a relief.
Yeah, I think most kids when they're reading these books and they see themselves in the pages, it's true. A lot of them see the humor a lot faster than the adults do, because we're obviously looking at it through the lens of oh my God, that was like one of the worst years of my life. I hated it. I had this embarrassing thing happen. And so we're reflecting on it in such a different manner. And kids, man, they're able to find like the funniest things that I don't even necessarily realize was funny. A kid will be laughing like, oh my gosh, look at her there with her texts or her journals. And they would laugh over things that, you know, you're meant to be serious, but you realize, oh, it's their coping mechanism. Like there are ways that these kids are dealing with all this as well. And it's great for all.
And I am laughing. You know, it's a fine line, but I am laughing at myself while also having compassion with myself. Mm. I mean, there are some very silly moments. There's like, there's a boy that I had a big crush on and I went to my first school dance and I had my first slow dance with this boy. And then I thought that he would, maybe he took my number, so I thought he'd call or something, and I'm waiting for him to call. And I spend a very melancholy day listening to Berlin's You Take My Breath Away on my record player over and over again, and looking out the window and petting my cat and writing poetry in my journal.
She put a poem in that's so heart-wrenching, achingly written by a 13-year-old. I wrote an ode to him.
Yeah. and I put it in its entirety in the book because I am both honoring that feeling, which was very genuine with cute little me. And I'm also laughing gently at her, like, you're very silly. Yeah. Because I think that's a healthy thing. I it's not a mocking laugh. It's a loving laugh. And I think if we all learn to laugh at ourselves a little while still loving and respecting ourselves, that's a really healthy way to go through life.
Yeah. And there's some really funny scenes in there where she fantasizes a lot. And I got to say, those, do you remember what those fantasies are like when you're 13 years old? They're so
I do.
Earnest. And they're so, you feel them so passionately.
Yeah.
And as a 47-year-old looking back and illustrating that, I can remember what the 13-year-old feels. I can put in all the drama that the 13-year-old feels. And yet I can also laugh at, you know, these ZZ Top characters.
I wanted to ask you, Lewin, about those fantasy sequences. So periodically, as Shannon, as a 13-year-old, is, you know, dreaming about, one of them is where she's going to become, like this magical makeover van is going to arrive. And, like, you know, this beautiful, tall, curly, redheaded woman steps out, super fashionable, and, like, you know, gives her a makeover. And there's one where she's encountering a beautiful, also redheaded adult book publisher who is offering to publish her books and give her $1 million. And there's, you know, each time she's in these fantasies. And the fairy godmother type, you know, warm, fuzzy hug is coming from an adult woman with red hair. And then at the very end, she's descended into her darkest places of her depression. And the book actually ends with a series of light-filled hugs in panels. And she's being hugged. All of those characters have come back and they all have red hair. Tell me what's going on there.
Yeah, can you guess what that might possibly be? Wow.
In the script, I called them the adult Shannons.
Yeah.
So each one is a different kind of possible future Shannon. So they're designed to look like adult me.
Yeah.
But and in different form.
I know what adult Shannon looks like. I don't expect that the kids would. But the red hair hopefully is a bit of a giveaway.
Yeah.
But that's definitely something that Jenna had written into the script. And then I realized this is going to be sort of hard to communicate, but it's also going to be a lot of fun to communicate.
Yeah.
And particularly with the last chapter of the book, when you see all those characters coming into each other, I think that's when the reader starts to realize, oh, that's who all these characters are, all these manifestations of Shannon, who she is and who she could possibly be.
Yeah. And it's just such a beautiful, it's just such a beautiful sentiment too, that, you know, it ends with, you know, that I don't know, savior is the wrong word, but the thing that heals her, you know, the healing comes from self, from her figuring out how to love herself.
That's exactly it. That last panel of fantasy illustrations, that was actually really hard to draw because it is all these characters. I think what was hard to draw was little Shannon's reaction to all of those older characters, because there is something where Shannon, when she's talking about this book, she's always saying, you know, something sort of happened to me in that eighth grade year, something changed in me. Mm-hmm. And I somehow feel like that moment is the moment that's being illustrated, that
yeah.
she learns how to heal herself. She learns how to accept herself. And that could be the pathway out of depression for her particular case. And it's an impossible thing to draw, and it's an incredible thing to draw. And, you know, I hope that what Shannon wrote on the page, I was able to translate in some way in picture.
Wynne and I often talk about how stories don't really end
yeah.
because you keep living. And so even though my eighth grade year was over a long time ago, that story isn't over. And we really believe, like, you can go back in time and change things.
Yeah,
you can, in a way. Even some forms of therapy will have you remember, go back into, in your memory, an event which was unhappy and change what happens. And by, it's like you rewire your brain by reimagining it. Like, it's never too late. You didn't have any friends when you were younger. Well, the author photo that we have in this book is a photo of me and Wynne together when we were 13. We didn't meet till we were 30. But she masterfully photoshopped herself into a photo of 13-year-old me with 13-year-old her. Mm-hmm. And it looks like we're together, we're 13. Yeah. And that is incredibly emotionally healing. Like, any, you don't have to have an illustrator to do this. Like, in our own thoughts, we can, like, rewrite our history by changing how we feel about it, by imagining it a new way. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of magic.
Shannon Hale is the best-selling author of Princess Academy and The Goose Girl. Her latest is a memoir in graphic novel format of her eighth grade year. It's called Friends Forever. It's the third in a trilogy of memoirs, illustrated by award-winning illustrator Lei Nguyen Pham. Thank you both for sharing your time with us today.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks for asking such great questions.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, how to enjoy the company of your own thoughts.
Thank you for listening to Top of Mind. I'm Ciara Hewlett. Go to any doctor's office waiting room and what will you see? Almost everyone on their phones. It's rare these days to see people just thinking when they have nothing to do. One study even found more people would prefer to give themselves an electric shock than sit with their thoughts. Why don't we enjoy thinking? Psychologist Aaron Westgate has been studying how to make thinking a more pleasurable experience. She teaches at the University of Florida and joins me on the line now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
You have a pretty funny quote in your most recent study. It says, "My favorite part of quarantine is that we were all forced to be alone with our thoughts for a little bit. And everyone was like, absolutely not. I will learn how to bake bread from scratch." Yeah. Why would people prefer to bake bread or learn how to bake bread or even receive an electric shock over just sitting and thinking?
Well, you know, that was a question that puzzled us for years, because thinking seems so easy. It looks like doing nothing, right? You just
right.
need to sit and daydream. And what's not to like about that? But what we find when we bring folks into the lab is that thinking is actually really hard, that you have to be the screenwriter and actor and audience of this whole sort of mental performance. And that's really demanding and it's effortful. And we know that people when given a choice, tend to prefer easier, enjoyable activities to effortful ones.
Hmm. Do you think this could also be because we're just not used to thinking anymore as much because of technology? So sitting with our thoughts is more uncomfortable and unfamiliar?
You know, that's something I've wondered about a lot. So I'm in my 30s. I definitely grew up very much sort of part of the internet and iPhone generation, right? But, you know, what we see is that if this was the case, if it was just that, you know, we all have this technology around and we've gotten used to it and we don't have to think, that older adults would be a lot better at it. That, you know, college students and folks in their teens, 20s, 30s wouldn't be great at it, but that folks in their 60s, 70s, and 80s would. And that's not what we find. So when we actually go out, I know. One study, we actually went to a local church in Charlottesville, Virginia, and asked congregants there, many of whom were much older, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s. I think we had one or two 80-year-olds. And asked them, you know, we want you to go home and find a time when you don't have any distractions and just try and sit and enjoy your thoughts. You can think about anything you want, but the goal is to really make this be a pleasant experience. And I really thought that they would come back and be like, that was great. You know, I used to love thinking, I do it all the time. Like, it was fantastic. And what we found was that those seniors that we asked to think, they didn't really enjoy it any more than our college students did, even though they've had a long, long parts of their life where they probably did have more time to sit and think because they had fewer, you know, technology and distractions than folks today. It didn't seem to help. It didn't seem like they were enjoying this much more than the younger folks were.
Well, that's a little comforting that we're not ruining ourselves with technology.
In a backwards kind of way, yes.
Do you think it could also be too that it's not only taxing to have to like try and consciously think, but also that our minds, do they generally tend to go automatically to the negative and think about our worries and stresses and all of that? And so then it's not a very pleasant experience.
You know, I think the answer to that is a little bit more mundane and boring in a sense. It's not that when we let people think in this kind of way that they go straight to the negative. We don't see that they ruminate. They do something much more basic, which is they tend to sort of drift out of thinking about positive activities and tend to start planning their own day. So, you know, what do I have to do tomorrow? And when we ask people, you know, would you rather sit and think for pleasure or would you rather plan your day? People think that planning their day is like a more meaningful, worthwhile use of time. But when we ask them to do it, they don't enjoy it. And so it's not necessarily that, you know, you're sitting there and experiencing like this existential horror at the emptiness of your life and thinking about all your character flaws. But people do get distracted by their sort of daily concerns, like, oh, I need to drop my kid off at school, or, oh, did I check the mailbox? Did I leave the stove running? These kinds of everyday sort of hassles and concerns that aren't very enjoyable to think about, and that also aren't very meaningful, it turns out, for people to spend time reflecting on.
Is there really a problem, though, here, if we don't like to sit and think, if we don't like the company of our own thoughts and we'd rather just jump on our phone to entertain ourselves? Is that problematic?
That's a great question. And I think it may be one in some ways that's better answered by philosophy than by psychology. So we do know that thinking for pleasure or daydreaming can be a way to distract yourself from sort of everyday hassles and distractions. There are some studies, for instance, that show that if you make, psychologists are great, we make people put their hands in a like a bucket of ice water. This is called a cold presser task. And you basically see how long people can keep their hands in the ice water, which if you've ever done is very unpleasant and painful.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun.
No, it's not fun. You can try it yourself with a cooler at home. It is not great. But when we ask people, not us, this is other researchers that did this, but when people are asked to spend that time daydreaming about pleasant fantasies, they're actually able to keep their hands in that cold water for longer.
Oh.
And so what it suggests is, yeah, that it's not necessarily that we're ruining our lives or anything by not engaging in these kinds of pleasant thoughts, but that it's a useful tool that we have at our disposal. It's always with us. You know, we always have our mind here. It's free. We can use it in all these great ways. And it may be more the case that this is a tool that people are overlooking or not using as often as they could because they're not aware of how enjoyable it could be or how to think in ways that do make it more enjoyable and rewarding.
But the distinction there and to get that reward, the benefits of sitting and thinking is that it needs to be positive. It can't just be like you were talking about, just planning your day or just letting your mind just kind of go to whatever it goes to, which might be whatever you're worrying about or, you know, things like that. You have to be thinking about positive things.
Yeah. So this surprised us because it seems like people should intuitively just know what to think about if you ask them to enjoy their own thoughts. And it turns out that people don't really seem to have a great grasp on this. You want to think about something that's positive, but you also want to think about something that's meaningful. So eating ice cream is a positive, pleasant memory or, you know, thing to look forward to. But for most people, it's not going to be a deeply meaningful experience. So you want to pick things that are both positive and meaningful. Things like, you know, reflecting on your wedding day or thinking about, you know, the next time you're going to see friends and family. And it's these positive, meaningful types of topics that we see really pay off in enjoyable experiences when we ask people to try and think in these kinds of ways.
Can you give us some more examples of topics that would be both positive and meaningful for thought sessions?
So I personally actually keep, I call it sort of a stable. I have this metaphor where it's like a stable and I have all these little horses in the stable and each horse is a different topic that's positive and meaningful for me. So one of them might be planning a scuba trip. One of them might be seeing my colleagues at a conference next summer, which might not be meaningful to other people, but is to me. What we know from what participants in our studies have told us is that for most people, meaningful topics tend to be about other people. They're social. So we have this one, we always ask people what they thought about. And we have this one participant who told us that she imagined being at a river with her boyfriend and their dog and playing fetch with their dog in the river and going fishing together and then sitting and grilling up the salmon later and then like lying all together and watching the stars. And I feel like I love this example because it hits on all these components of what makes experiences meaningful to people, that there's value in it, there's purpose, there's significance. It really is tying together those social themes with these sorts of transcendent experiences people really care about. And those don't have to be real experiences. Like this woman who was telling us about what she thought about, this wasn't something that had actually happened. It was just something she created in her mind. And I think that's one thing that's really powerful potentially about thinking for pleasure is that it frees you from reality. So, you know, we've been in quarantine, there's been a pandemic going on. We may be limited in the kinds of experiences we've been able to actually have over the past year, but in our own minds, we can imagine whatever world we want and imagine what it would be like to live in that. And I think that really opens up the space for what a meaningful, positive thing to think about can be.
I'm speaking with Erin Westgate. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Florida, and she's done a lot of research into thinking and why it's so hard for us to do and why we don't like to just sit with our thoughts. Professor Westgate, if our brains do automatically go to more mundane things when we're thinking that we don't enjoy thinking about, our biology is that way if our brains are automatically going there. And so you are trying to help people change their thoughts to make them more meaningful and positive, as we've talked about. But couldn't that also be a problem, that our brains are supposed to go to where they naturally go?
Yeah. And, you know, if you think about it, it makes sense. There's this phrase that thinking is for doing, that the reason that we can think at all is because it's supposed to facilitate us getting out and doing the things in the world that we need to do to survive and flourish. And we wouldn't get very far if we just sat on a rock and lost ourselves in our daydreams 24/7. And certainly, I don't think anyone would think that that is what we should do, that completely retreating into our own thoughts is clearly not great either. And so the answer to why our thoughts sort of, you know, gravitate towards these sort of mundane daily concerns, the jury is still out. I personally think that it does have a lot to do with this idea that the reason that we can think is to help us navigate the world and, you know, this ability to really separate ourselves entirely from the outside world and retreat entirely into a world of our own thoughts. This is always a dangerous statement to make, but to my knowledge, that's not something any other species can do. It's pretty unique to humanity. And, you know, something that is that unique and is that rare, so to speak, on the planet. You know, dolphins, to our knowledge, aren't daydreaming. Bugs aren't daydreaming. Plants aren't daydreaming. That it's really something that only humans can do. Suggests that it's not something that's really necessary to live. If daydreaming were necessary, other animals would do it too. The fact that they probably don't suggest that this is sort of a bonus capability that human minds have.
Okay, so even though we don't naturally go to that, you know, we naturally more often go to the mundane things, planning our day, that kind of thing, or negative, worrisome thoughts, the fact at all that we can daydream, that we can generate positive, meaningful thoughts is it just shows that there's something, there's a reason we can do that.
Yeah. And I think it's really extraordinary. And, you know, this question of why do this at all? Like, why even bother with trying to have these kinds of thoughts? You know, I could go into psychological benefits about maybe why you should try to have this tool at your disposal. But I think one really profound philosophical reason is just because we can. And because as far as we know, we're the only species that can. And that's pretty incredible.
Why is generating thoughts so hard? Why are our minds so difficult to control?
So there's this really cool research that tried to track how long an average thought actually lasts, like in our minds, like how long you actually follow a single train of thought out. And the answer isn't in hours or minutes, it's in seconds. That the kinds of thoughts we have are like so fast and so fleeting. And it hasn't been necessary really in the history of the world for humans or animals to really have tight cognitive control over exactly what they're thinking. So this is a really recent ability. It's something that humans aren't great at. What we find in our own research is that people who have a background in mindfulness and mindfulness sort of meditation, they do a little better at trying to enjoy their own thoughts. But not a great deal better. But the fact that they do better at it at all does suggest that there are strategies that people can learn to just be better at controlling their thinking in general, not just controlling their thinking to have pleasant experiences, but just harnessing a little bit more the thoughts that do pass through their mind and getting them to go in the direction that they want.
So do you think then that if people were able to gain better control over their thoughts, that sitting and thinking would be a more pleasant experience overall, that if people did more mindfulness, more meditation, then it would be less taxing? Because that's one of the first question I asked you. You said the one of the big reasons why people don't enjoy it is because it takes a lot of cognitive energy.
You know, that I do think it would be easier for people. The other way, and this is kind of the sneaky way, is, you know, developing that kind of cognitive control takes a really long time and a lot of experience. And if thinking is hard, one thing that we can do is just make it easier for people. And so one technique that we've used in the lab that seems to work for people is to simply write out in advance the topics that you might want to think about. So we have them actually write down on little index cards, like, you know, I want to think about my dog, or I want to think about my graduation. And when we tell them then to go and have this kind of thinking experience, we sort of prompt them and say, oh, and by the way, you can look at the cards you filled out earlier. You could think about other things too, but you might want to use those as a basis for what you think
about. So you could even just, like when you're in the doctor's office waiting, you could even have a note on your phone. And so then instead of scrolling through Facebook or whatever, you can just look and see the list of topics that you have and then choose one of those to think about. And that'll help you not have to take so much energy to come up with to just think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I do that myself. I actually have a little note in my phone that has like topics to think about, because I'm the worst at like reaching for my phone. And I study this. I know better. And so I've been trying to do better myself.
Erin Westgate is a professor of psychology at the University of Florida. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I hope you've enjoyed these thoughts.
I have. I'm Ciara Hewlett.
And I'm Julie Rose. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Great to have you with us today. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemann produced the show. We're online at byuradio.org/topofmind. We'll talk soon.